I'm looking this morning at the well-known parable that Jesus tells us in Luke 18, verses 9 through 14, regarding the Pharisee and the publican, or the tax collector. Read with me as I begin with verse 9, where we're told that Jesus also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. Two men went up into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, prayed thus, "God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all that I get." But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even lift up his eyes to heaven, but beat his breast, saying, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." "I tell you," said Jesus, "this man, the tax collector, went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, but the one who humbles himself will be exalted." If you've been attending here for any period of time, as I've been going through the Epistle to the Romans, you've heard me make references to the Federal Vision. The Federal Vision was birthed at a pastor's conference in Louisiana at a church called Auburn Avenue Presbyterian Church in 2002. And it has gained quite a bit of notoriety since then. It has been explicitly condemned by numerous Reformed denominations as being out of harmony with the Westminster Standards. Nonetheless, this has not stopped men such as Jeff Myers, who I'm going to look at his exposition of this text, who is a pastor in the Presbyterian Church in America. And even though the PCA produced a report condemning the Federal Vision, Myers continues unabated in his teaching the distinctive doctrines of the Federal Vision. What are some of these doctrines that have created such a controversy? I guess perhaps the most important of their doctrines that is so controversial is the notion of temporal justification. That you can have people who are temporarily justified. And not just justified, but joined to Christ. Adopted, made an heir. In fact, have every redemptive benefit that the elect have, save one. They do not have the gift of perseverance. And so they may be grafted into Christ. They may have their sins forgiven, but at some point before they get to the grave, they will lapse and they will be cut off. And so it's temporary justification. Well, that fits nicely into an Arminian understanding of justification, but it has no place in a Reformed soteriology. The Federal Visionists also teach that by virtue of baptism, you are made a member of the covenant, and all the blessings, justification, union with Christ, adoption, become yours simply by being baptized. And so they have a very high sacramentology. These are two of the more distinctive doctrines that the Federal Vision have been espousing. But actually, the Federal Vision is the offspring of Norman Shepherd. Norman Shepherd was a professor of theology at Westminster Theological Seminary when I was there in the late 70s. And the controversy centered over his teaching that justification is by faith and works. Eventually, Shepherd was dismissed from the faculty, but he had sown the seeds of his own doctrine. And in fact, when that pastor's conference was convened in 2002, he was supposed to be the keynote speaker because the men who were there were his disciples. You see, Shepherd taught that James must be the lens through which we interpret Paul. And so when James teaches us that faith without works is dead, Shepherd said that's the key to understanding Paul. Therefore, we are justified by faith and works. Well, you can see that that's going to have a lot of flack flying at it. So Shepherd and his disciples refined their position, and they decided that the best way to communicate our concerns is to redefine faith. So when we say we're justified by faith, they say we are justified by faithful obedience, or what they like to call covenantal faithfulness. So as long as you remain covenantally faithful, you're justified. But at any time that you cease to be covenantally faithful, you lose that justification. So one day you can be justified, have your sins forgiven, and the next day you can be unjustified. Now this has drastic consequences for the entire Reformed understanding of salvation. Jeffrey Myers is one of the more vocal advocates of this doctrine. In fact, he was one of the original men. And because he is the pastor of a very prestigious Presbyterian church, he has gained quite a bit of notoriety. This is what he had to say about this parable. He says, and I'm going to pause as I go through his exposition and point out what I think are some serious, serious inaccuracies. He says, what is Lutheran about this parable? Now, notice he begins by trying to imply that Luther's doctrine of justification and Calvin's doctrine are not the same. But they were. The doctrine of justification by faith, as articulated by Luther and later by Calvin, agreed 100%. You see, this is a trick that Shepherd tried to a smokescreen. He said, you know, there's a Lutheran doctrine of justification, but there's also the Reformed doctrine, and the Reformed doctrine is not the same as the Lutheran. And when I was at Westminster, the entire church history department said, no, you are wrong. Luther's doctrine of justification and Calvin's doctrine of justification are identical. But now you'll see what Myers is trying to do. He's trying to imply that if you hold to the traditional reformational doctrine, you're being Lutheran. So he said, what is Lutheran about this parable? Be careful not to read much into it. The verb justify here cannot bear the full weight of the Lutheran doctrine. The reformational doctrine is what he's talking about. Always remember that theological terms used in systematic confessional theology are loaded with a great deal more than such words normally bear. And he refers to Bernd Poitras' symphonic theology. When terms justify or righteous all have the same root occur in the Bible, they never mean everything they mean in systematic theological context. The doctrine of justification is built up from many different passages, even from the story of the Bible as a whole, so that when we hear the word justification, we think of the whole shebang. But you can't dump all that into each occurrence of one of these words in the Bible. Here in Luke 18, we learn that the Pharisee was not righteous, even though he thought he was, and the tax collector, abbreviated TC, was righteous. The key to understand what righteous means. The key is to understand what righteous means. It does not refer to moral purity or conformity to a legal standard, the Lutheran mistake. Righteousness in the Bible means covenantal faithfulness. All right, the two Greek words, diakosune and diaku, are the Greek words that translate both justification and righteousness. Now, here's a challenge. Go to any Greek lexicon. Thayer, Artin, Ginrich, doesn't matter. Any Greek lexicon. And find one occurrence where it means what he says it means. that it refers to one who is covenantally faithful or a member of the covenant. It never means that. I said, just look at the lexical meaning. Dikaiosune, justification, to justify, righteous, never means to make one a member of a covenant or to establish one's membership by covenantal faithfulness. It never means that. And that's just really just poor scholarship. The Pharisee thinks he's righteous, but the fact is he's not. The tax collector does not claim to be righteous, but the fact he is. The tax collector goes back to his house justified or rectified, which in context does not claim to be right, but which means shown to be righteous. The text says nothing about God imputing an alien righteousness to the tax collector. One has to read that into the passage. Jesus, rather, is exposing the fact that the Pharisees are not truly faithful to the covenant. Really, they're not faithful to the covenant. The tax collector's humble plea fulfills the terms of the covenant. The tax collector is faithful to the covenant, that is, he is righteous. And what makes him so? His faith. Now notice that. How do you square that with what we just read a few minutes ago in the Heidelberg Catechism? If the faith of the tax collector is the basis for his acceptance to God, is that not subject to ebb and flow? Is not covenantal faithfulness something that is incremental, more obvious in some than in others? What level of covenantal faithfulness do you have before you lose your justification? You see, there's a lot at stake here. Is Myers right that the verb justify here has absolutely no connotation to an imputed righteousness, an alien righteousness, a perfect righteousness that is secured for us by Christ? It's not inconsequential that Myers denies, like Shepherd, the doctrine of the imputation of the active obedience of Christ. Has no place for it. Remember, we've often rehearsed the importance of the doctrine of the imputation of Christ's active obedience, by which we mean he fulfilled the law of God in his life. He completed, as the second Adam, what the first Adam failed to do. You have a bulletin insert from Jason Stillman, an article that originally appeared in Ligonier, about this important doctrine of the covenant of works that Christ fulfills. And not inconsequentially either, Myers has no place in his theology for the covenant of works. In fact, Myers is basically saying that the tax collector had to fulfill the demands of the covenant in the same way that Adam did, and could therefore fail. Well, let's look at the parable in itself, beginning by looking at why Jesus said he told the parable. This parable, he said, was told and was addressed to those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and treated others with contempt. So that's his audience. Two men are told, we're told, go up to the temple. It's an archaeological fact that the temple was located on the hill so that people had to go up the hill. And there were prescribed times a day for prayer. The temple courts were the place where people prayed. Any of you have ever been to Jerusalem, you've seen the Wailing Wall, where people will stand in front of the wall and offer up their prayers. This is something very similar. Matthew Henry, that old great Puritan commentator, and by the way, the gist of what I'm telling you is taken from him, notes that this was probably told because Jesus had actually observed these things happening. He didn't just make this up. Jesus was actually cognizant of this kind of stuff occurring. And so he begins by telling us about the two men. One is a Pharisee. Pharisees, and by the way, you do remember that the Apostle Paul was a Pharisee. The word Pharisee means one who is set apart. And they were known for their strong convictions about moral purity. In fact, as you read the Pharisee's prayer, if you can call it that, he's the kind of guy you'd like to have for a neighbor, wouldn't he? Very conscientious man. Very diligent, very scrupulous. And you can see how he is detail-oriented and how regimented his life is. In many ways, it's commendable. And we have to take him at face value that what he's telling us is true. Well, look at the particulars of this man. He stands by himself. And by the way, there's nothing to be taken by the word standing as opposed to kneeling. Everybody stood. He stands and he prayed the following prayer. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men. So he immediately begins to distinguish himself from other men. But look at the list of vices that he has avoided. Primarily, he's negative in how he is comparing and contrasting himself with the worst sort of people. He says, I'm not an extortioner. He didn't take money from people. I'm not unjust. I treat people fairly. I'm not immoral. I'm not an adulterer. And then he immediately makes reference to the most obvious example of his moral purity, a tax collector. Now, we looked at what a Pharisee was, and it was a group of religious zealots who was zealous for the law and for the law of Moses. They appear frequently in the gospel accounts as the adversaries of Jesus along with the Sadducees. But the Pharisees and the Sadducees were actually opponents. They didn't get along at all. A tax collector, or as the old King James says, a publican, was someone who was in service to Rome. They collected taxes. And as such, they were viewed as collaborators and were looked upon as not the most savory of folk. Can you name the most prominent tax collector in the Bible? Any of you know who? One of the apostles. Which one? Who? Matthew was a tax collector. Now, what is interesting is when you look at the list of apostles that Jesus called, some of them were naturally adversarial. Matthew's a tax collector, and there are others of the apostles who held tax collectors with contempt, and this Pharisee was just that kind of person. That fella is in cahoots with the Romans. He's taking taxes from his kinsmen. He's a flunky for Rome. I'm not like that guy. I have honor. I'm not going to stoop to that level to make a living. So he commends himself. He commends himself by, first of all, describing his virtues in terms of how he tithes twice a week. I fast twice a week. I give a tithe of all that I get. In other words, he is someone who knows his obligations as set forth in the Decalogue. He knows the law of Moses. He is a zealot for the law. The Apostle Paul, as I told you, was a Pharisee. In fact, he says he was raised a Pharisee and he was a Pharisee of Pharisees. But of all groups of Jews that were zealous for the law, none surpassed the Pharisees. So that Paul could say in Romans about his countrymen, primarily referencing the Pharisees, They have a zeal for God, but it's not according to knowledge. And so this man looks inwardly and he commends himself. He finds that he's virtuous. He finds that he is benevolent. And he looks upon that as the grounds upon which God will accept him, because he has brought his life into as close as conformity to the law of God as he could imagine. So why would not God accept him? Oh, the problem with this man was he never saw himself, or he never saw God more precisely in the right light. Not only is he measuring himself against other men, he is measuring God in just the same way. You see, his God doesn't have the kind of awesome moral perfections that so staggered the prophet Isaiah. You remember Isaiah 6? In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple, and smoke came billowing out of the temple, and these angelic beings were flying around saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts." So Isaiah's response is, "I'll compare myself to my countrymen." No, what did he do? "Woe is me, I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips. How do I speak about myself? This is a prophet, and I live amongst some unclean people." The Pharisee never saw himself that way. And because he never saw himself that way, he never saw the need for the kind of cleansing that Isaiah needed. A coal from the altar where atonement was made for sin. Now let's look quickly at the tax collector. Notice it says that the tax collector stood afar off. He no doubt saw the glare from the eyes of the Pharisee. But this man would not so much as lift up his eyes. It was standard procedure when you prayed to lift your hands up. This man, not only does he not lift his hands up, he doesn't lift his head up. Instead, it says he beats his chest. He's doing this. He's doing his mea culpa, mea culpa. My sin, my sin. Be merciful, he says, to me, a sinner. Do you know he's quoting scripture? He's quoting the penitential Psalms of David. After David had been confronted by Nathanael the prophet, and David confesses his sin. "In sin did my mother conceive me. Against thee and thee only have I done this evil and wicked thing." The publican is overwhelmed with a sense of his own personal unworthiness. Oh, he could have probably found some other people who were worse sinners than him and could have said, I've done some bad things, and, you know, I don't always do what I should do, but at least I'm better than that. That is always the human tendency, to find other people of whom we are at least not in that category. But he won't do that. "Be merciful to me, the sinner." The English doesn't convey it, but in Psalm 130, when David prays, "The God be merciful to me, the sinner," the literal rendering is, "God be propitious." Be propitious. What does that word mean? Propitiation. It means to avert wrath by inflicting judgment on another. You see, David and the tax collector knew that if God judges me for my sin, if I get what I deserve, I'm going to perish under his judgment. God, make a propitiation for me. I am guilty. There is no question about it. Sin has undone me. I cannot make amends by repentance. I can't reform my life and make satisfaction. Either you are propitious toward me or I perish. Propitiation means that God pours out his wrath, all right, but but he pours it out somewhere else. This is what Paul talks about in Romans chapter 3, where he tells us that God sent forth his Son to be a propitiation for sin. That is, a substitute who bears divine judgment and thus absorbs in his body and soul the judgment due to sinners. The tax collector is praying, God, be propitious to me. My sins are going to be punished, but please find a propitiation for me. And that is the gospel, that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners. How? By passively, we call the active and passive obedience of Christ, by passively obeying the word of his Father's will and enduring the penalty of the broken law in his self. Now then, Jesus said, I tell you, the tax collector went down to his house justified. Didn't say the man felt any better. Doesn't say that the man had any sense of assurance. It certainly doesn't say that he was made righteous, as the Roman Catholic Church teaches. But does it mean that he went down there because he was covenantally faithful? If you had asked him, he would have been bewildered at the thought. Me? Covenantally faithful? Are you kidding? I just ask God to be merciful to me. There's nothing I can lay claim to. What Myers is doing is putting this man in the shoes of the Pharisee where he can say, okay, I have been covenantally faithful. Now, which of these two men thought that he was faithful to the covenant? Which one? The Pharisee. And yet he wasn't. Listen, if covenantal faithfulness doesn't involve what the Pharisee was doing, pray tell, what does it involve? Covenantal faithfulness is simply a code word for legal obedience. Simply put, God is going to treat me as righteous because I have been righteous. As my righteousness measured up to the level of what God will require? My friends, if your covenantal faithfulness is the grounds upon which you're hinging your acceptance with God, you'll always be doing this. Have I done enough? Have I been covenantally faithful enough? Maybe not today. My good friend C. Fitzsimon Allison, when I edited the book with Guy Waters, Faith Alone, we recruited Bishop Fitzsimmons to write a chapter in our book about the importance of the doctrine of imputation. We knew about him because he had written a book called The Cruelty of Heresy. He says heresy is always cruel. It's cruel to those who imbibe it. And I can think of no heresy that's crueler than this one. Of putting people under the yoke. Of acceptance with God is based upon the degree of covenantal faithfulness that you maintain. I can think of nothing, pastorally speaking, that will drive people faster into despair than that one. Because it's either going to drive you into despair or it's going to turn you into a Pharisee in which you congratulate yourself constantly. The Lutheran doctrine, which he has nothing but contempt for, is the reformational doctrine. We are justified by faith that relies on and looks to Christ only. It is by that faith alone that we are declared acceptable to God. Any other basis makes us obnoxious to God Himself. May God deliver us from such errors. As the elders and deacons come forward now, we welcome you to participate in the Lord's table.